Welcome to the History AI Podcast, where the past comes alive with facts, anecdotes, and a dash of humor. Here are your hosts, Chuck and Marco.
Welcome back to the History AI Podcast, where history comes alive one story at a time. I'm Chuck.
And I'm Marco. Today, we're diving into a rebellion that shook the Roman Empire to its core, the Great Jewish Revolt.
That's right, Marco. It's one of the most significant uprisings in antiquity, and it set the stage for some monumental shifts in history,
including the destruction of the Second Temple. It's a story of defiance, strategy, and, ultimately, tragedy. So, buckle up, folks. We're heading back to 1st century Judea.
All right, let's set the stage for the Great Jewish Revolt. It's the 1st century CE, and Judea is under Roman rule. Now, Judea wasn't exactly a thriving, happy province within the empire. It was a powder keg of cultural, religious, and political tension.
Right. Judea had been under Roman control since Pompey the Great conquered it in 63 BCE. But even before that, it had a long history of resisting foreign domination. From the Assyrians to the Babylonians, the Jews had developed a strong identity centered around their religion and their land.
And when the Romans came along, that identity didn't mesh well with imperial rule. See, the Romans were all about expanding their empire, and they had a pretty straightforward approach to governance: pay your taxes, obey Roman laws, and respect Roman gods, or at least pretend to.
But the Jews were monotheistic. They weren't going to start worshipping Jupiter or participating in pagan rituals just because Rome told them to.
Exactly. Religion wasn't just a belief system for the Jewish people, it was the core of their culture and law. The Torah governed how they lived, worked, and worshipped. So, when Roman officials tried to impose their own practices, it wasn't just offensive, it was existential.
Then there's the taxation issue. Rome didn't just rule Judea, they squeezed it dry. Taxation was heavy, and the way it was collected made it worse.
Yeah. Rome used tax farmers, basically private contractors who bid for the right to collect taxes. These guys weren't exactly known for their fairness or generosity.
More like legalized extortion. If you couldn't pay, they'd seize your land, your livestock, even your family members in some cases.
And this economic strain hit Judea particularly hard because much of the population was already struggling. A large portion of the society was agrarian, working small plots of land to barely make ends meet. Add in Roman taxes, and you've got a recipe for widespread resentment.
Let's not forget about the Romans' military presence. Judea was essentially an occupied territory. Roman soldiers were stationed in major cities like Jerusalem, and their presence wasn't exactly subtle.
Right. The soldiers were there to enforce order, but they often stirred up more unrest. They didn't respect Jewish customs and sometimes went out of their way to provoke the locals.
A perfect example of this is the infamous incident where Emperor Caligula, in the 40s CE, tried to have his statue installed in the Jewish temple in Jerusalem.
That's a colossal no-no. The temple was the holiest site in Judaism, and placing a statue of a Roman emperor, a mortal man who was worshipped as a god, was beyond sacrilegious.
Although the statue wasn't actually installed, the fact that it was even proposed shows how out of touch the Romans were with the people they were ruling.
Fast forward to the 60s CE, and things had reached a boiling point. By this time, Emperor Nero was on the throne, and Judea was under the control of a governor named Jesias Florus.
Oh, Florus. This guy was the worst. He wasn't just corrupt, he was cartoonishly corrupt. He looted the temple treasury in 66 CE, supposedly to pay off tax debts, but really just to line his own pockets.
And the temple wasn't just a building, it was the heart of Jewish religious life and a symbol of their identity. Florus might as well have declared war right then and there.
Which, in a way, he did. The people of Jerusalem rose up in outrage, sparking riots. And here's the thing, these weren't just isolated protests. This was the moment when decades of tension and resentment exploded into full-scale rebellion.
So to recap, you've got heavy taxes, religious disrespect, a corrupt governor, and an occupying force that's overstayed its welcome. All of that creates the perfect storm for rebellion.
And once the revolt began, there was no turning back.
All right, let's dive into how the rebellion actually got underway. It's 66 CE, and the spark was Florus's infamous raid on the temple treasury. He claimed he was collecting unpaid taxes, but to the Jewish population, it felt like the ultimate insult.
Right, and this wasn't just about the money, although, to be fair, taking temple funds that were meant for religious purposes didn't win him any fans. This was about Roman disrespect for Jewish autonomy and their sacred traditions. The temple was the heart of Jewish religious life, and Florus's actions were seen as nothing short of blasphemy.
This led to riots in Jerusalem. The people were outraged, and the unrest quickly spiraled out of control. Florus tried to crush the uprising, but his heavy-handed tactics only fanned the flames.
One key moment early in the revolt was when Jewish rebels successfully expelled the Roman garrison from Jerusalem. This was a huge deal. The Romans were known for their military prowess, so the fact that local fighters could defeat them gave the rebels a massive morale boost.
It also sent a clear message to Rome. This wasn't just a riot, they were dealing with a full-blown rebellion. The rebels weren't just fighting for survival, they were fighting for independence.
Exactly. And the rebels weren't some disorganized mob. Initially, there was a surprising level of coordination. A provisional Jewish government was formed to oversee the revolt. This council, known as the Sanhedrin, organized the defense of Jerusalem and other strongholds across Judea.
Meanwhile, various factions within the Jewish community began to emerge as key players in the revolt. The most notable were the Zealots and the Sicarii.
Let's start with the Zealots. These guys were hardcore nationalists who believed that Judea should be free from Roman rule at any cost. They were willing to fight to the death for their cause.
Then there were the Sicarii. If the Zealots were hardcore, the Sicarii were next level. Their name comes from the Latin word sicca, meaning dagger, and they earned their reputation as assassins.
Yeah, their tactic was simple, but terrifying. They'd infiltrate crowds, assassinate Roman officials or Jewish collaborators, and then disappear before anyone realized what had happened.
Ruthless, but effective. The Sicarii's actions added to the chaos, and they were instrumental in spreading fear among Roman sympathizers.
So, while the rebels were making significant gains, they were also laying the groundwork for some internal divisions. These factions didn't always agree on strategy or leadership, which would become a major issue later on.
But for now, the rebellion was gaining momentum. Outside of Jerusalem, the fighting spread to other parts of Judea. Towns like Sepphoris and Jotapata became battlegrounds as the rebels clashed with Roman forces.
And let's not forget the psychological impact. News of the rebellion spread far and wide. For the first time, Rome was being openly defied in one of its provinces, and that kind of resistance was unheard of.
Exactly. Rome's reputation as an unstoppable force was being challenged. Back in Rome, Emperor Nero realized this wasn't just some minor skirmish. It was a serious threat, and it demanded a serious response.
Enter General Vespasian.
Vespasian was one of Rome's most experienced and capable generals. Nero tasked him with crushing the rebellion, and he didn't come alone. He brought 3 legions, around 60,000 soldiers, into Judea.
And let's be clear, this wasn't just a Roman army. This was the Roman war machine. These soldiers were highly trained, disciplined, and equipped with the best weapons and siege equipment of the era.
Vespasian's approach was methodical. He wasn't going to charge straight into Jerusalem. Instead, he focused on isolating the city by capturing surrounding towns and strongholds. His goal was to cut off the rebels' resources and weaken their position before launching a full-scale assault.
One of the key battles early on was the Siege of Jotapata in 67 CE. This town, led by the Jewish commander Josephus, yes, the same Josephus who would later become a historian, was a major stronghold for the rebels.
The siege lasted 47 days, and it was brutal. The Romans eventually overpowered the defenders, killing thousands and capturing Josephus.
Interestingly, Josephus claimed that he was captured after hiding in a cave and convincing the Romans that he could be useful to them. He ended up becoming a key chronicler of the revolt, which is why we know so much about it today.
That's right. His account, The Jewish War, is one of our main sources for this period, though we have to take it with a grain of salt. He was writing under Roman patronage, so his perspective is, let's say, biased.
Still, his writings give us incredible insight into the rebellion's events and the people involved.
As Vespasian continued his campaign, the Romans methodically captured town after town, driving the rebels back toward Jerusalem. By 68 CE, most of Judea was under Roman control.
Jerusalem, however, remained defiant. It became the central stronghold for the rebellion, and the stage was set for one of the most infamous sieges in history.
All right, let's get into the heart of the great Jewish revolt, the Siege of Jerusalem. By 70 CE, Jerusalem had become the last major stronghold of the rebellion. The Romans, now led by Titus, the son of Vespasian, were determined to crush the revolt once and for all.
But this wasn't just a military operation, it was a statement. Jerusalem wasn't just any city. It was the spiritual and cultural heart of the Jewish people. Crushing it meant sending a message to the entire Roman Empire: rebellions will not be tolerated.
Exactly. And the timing was significant. By this point, Vespasian had been declared emperor after Nero's death, so this siege wasn't just about putting down a revolt, it was about cementing Vespasian's legitimacy as Rome's ruler.
Let's talk about Jerusalem itself. The city was a fortress. It had natural defenses, sitting on a series of hills, and it was surrounded by three massive walls. Inside those walls were narrow streets, crowded homes, and, of course, the Temple Mount, which was the city's centerpiece.
But the city wasn't just packed with rebels, it was also packed with civilians. And here's why: the siege began during Passover, one of the most important Jewish festivals. Pilgrims from all over Judea had flocked to Jerusalem to celebrate.
That meant the population of the city was far larger than usual, likely in the hundreds of thousands. Food and water were already in short supply, even before the siege began.
And let's not forget the internal divisions among the rebels. At this point, the Zealots and other factions were turning on each other. Instead of uniting against the Romans, they were fighting each other for control of the city.
Talk about self-sabotage. The infighting was so bad that some factions actually burned parts of the city's grain supplies to keep them out of their rivals' hands.
That decision would come back to haunt them. When Titus arrived with his army, four legions, roughly 80,000 soldiers, the Romans didn't just storm the city. They set up a full-scale siege, surrounding Jerusalem and cutting off all supplies.
This is where the Roman war machine really showed its strength. They built a massive encampment around the city and used their engineering expertise to construct siege towers, battering rams, and even a circumvallation, a wall around Jerusalem to ensure no one could escape.
Starvation quickly set in. Josephus, who was in the Roman camp at the time, described the horrors of the siege in vivid detail. People were eating leather, straw, and even each other in a desperate attempt to survive.
It's absolutely horrifying. And while the people were starving, the Romans were slowly breaking through the city's defenses. They began by breaching the outer wall, then the second wall, and finally the third wall, which was the last line of defense.
Once the Romans were inside the city, the fighting became even more brutal. The rebels fought fiercely, retreating street by street toward the Temple Mount. The temple itself became their final stronghold.
And here's where things get truly devastating. The temple was the holiest site in Judaism, and the rebels were determined to defend it at all costs. But the Romans were just as determined to destroy it.
According to Josephus, Titus originally wanted to preserve the temple, both as a symbol of Roman victory and because of its architectural significance. But in the chaos of battle, a Roman soldier allegedly threw a burning torch into the temple, setting it ablaze.
The fire spread quickly, engulfing the entire structure. Josephus wrote that the flames were so intense, the gold ornaments inside the temple melted and ran into the cracks of the stone foundation.
By the time the fire was extinguished, the second temple was nothing more than ruins. It was a devastating blow to the Jewish people. The temple wasn't just a building, it was the center of their religious, cultural, and national identity.
And the destruction didn't stop there. Titus ordered the city to be systematically razed. The walls were torn down, the homes were destroyed, and the population was decimated.
The numbers are staggering. Josephus claims that over 1 million people died during the siege and its aftermath, though modern historians believe the number was likely lower, still in the hundreds of thousands. Tens of thousands more were enslaved and taken to Rome.
One of the most haunting details is that many of the captives were forced to participate in Titus's triumphal parade in Rome. This was the Roman way of celebrating victory, parading their spoils of war, including people, through the streets of the capital.
If you visit Rome today, you can still see the Arch of Titus, which depicts Roman soldiers carrying the temple treasures, the menorah, the trumpets, and other sacred objects.
It's a chilling reminder of the human cost of the revolt.
The siege of Jerusalem effectively ended the Great Jewish Revolt. With the city and the temple destroyed, any remaining resistance was scattered and isolated. The fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 CE didn't just mark the end of the Great Jewish Revolt, it signaled a turning point in Jewish history and had far-reaching consequences for the Roman Empire as well.
Let's start with the immediate aftermath. After the siege, the Romans had total control over Judea. They didn't just defeat the rebellion, they crushed it, ensuring there would be no second chance for the rebels to rise again.
Titus left a clear message: Judea was to remain under Roman authority, and any hint of defiance would be met with overwhelming force. Jerusalem itself was left in ruins. Titus ordered the city to be razed, sparing only a few towers and portions of the walls to serve as grim reminders of Rome's might.
For the Jewish people, the loss of the Second Temple was catastrophic. The temple wasn't just a religious building, it was the heart of Jewish worship, the center of their sacrifices, and the physical representation of their covenant with God. Its destruction created a theological and cultural crisis.
Without the temple, the entire structure of Jewish religious life had to change. Temple sacrifices were no longer possible, which forced a shift towards synagogue worship and a focus on prayer and study of the Torah. This is when Rabbinic Judaism began to take shape, emphasizing the role of rabbis and religious scholars in interpreting Jewish law and maintaining the faith.
And then there was the human cost. Josephus claimed that over 1 million people were killed in the siege and the fighting leading up to it, though modern historians estimate the number to be closer to hundreds of thousands. Tens of thousands more were taken as slaves.
Many of these captives were sent to Rome, where they were either sold into slavery or used as labor to build public works projects. One such project was the Colosseum.
Right, the Colosseum. Part of its funding came from the spoils of the war, including the treasures looted from the temple in Jerusalem. So, in a way, the Colosseum stands as a monument to Rome's victory in the Great Jewish Revolt.
Another chilling aspect of the aftermath was Titus's triumphal parade in Rome. Captives from Judea, including Jewish rebels, were marched through the streets as trophies. The Arch of Titus, which still stands in Rome today, commemorates this victory, depicting Roman soldiers carrying the temple's sacred menorah and other treasures.
But the story of the revolt doesn't end with Jerusalem. While most of Judea was under Roman control by 70 CE, a few pockets of resistance held out, the most famous being Masada.
Masada was a fortress built by King Herod on a plateau overlooking the Dead Sea. After the fall of Jerusalem, it became the last stronghold of the Sicarii, the most radical faction of the Jewish rebels.
The Romans didn't leave loose ends. In 73 CE, they laid siege to Masada, building an enormous ramp to reach the fortress.
The siege ended in a tragic and dramatic fashion. According to Josephus, when the Romans finally breached the walls, they found that nearly all of the defenders had taken their own lives rather than be captured.
The fall of Masada marked the official end of the Great Jewish Revolt, but the psychological and cultural scars would last for centuries.
Speaking of cultural scars, the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple initiated the Jewish diaspora. With Judea devastated, many Jews were forced to flee, scattering across the Roman Empire and beyond.
This dispersion fundamentally changed Jewish identity. Without a homeland or a central temple, the Jewish people became a diasporic community, relying on shared traditions, religious practices, and the study of scripture to maintain their cultural identity.
Over time, this resilience became a defining characteristic of Jewish history. Despite the devastation, the Jewish people adapted, survived, and preserved their traditions, even in the face of adversity.
For Rome, the victory in Judea solidified its reputation as a seemingly invincible empire. Titus, who had led the siege, returned to Rome as a hero and eventually became emperor.
But the revolt also revealed some cracks in the empire's foundation. The sheer scale of the rebellion and the resources required to crush it exposed how difficult it was to manage such a vast and diverse empire.
And Judea wasn't done with rebellion. Just a few decades later, there would be another major uprising, the Bar Kokhba Revolt in 132 CE.
That's a story for another episode. For now, though, the Great Jewish Revolt remains a powerful example of both the destructive force of imperial conquest and the resilience of a people fighting for their identity.
It's a reminder that history is rarely simple. The aftermath of this revolt shaped not just the Jewish people, but the Roman Empire and, in some ways, the entire course of Western history. That's it for today's episode, folks. The Great Jewish Revolt is a powerful reminder of how history is shaped by resistance and resilience.
Thanks for joining us on this journey. Don't forget to rate, subscribe, and share the History AI podcast.
And hey, a 5-star review isn't just a nice gesture, it helps us grow and bring you more episodes like this.
Want to suggest a topic? Hit us up on social media. And don't forget to check out our new merch, link in the show notes.
Remember, all our episodes are evergreen, so you can dive into any topic, anytime.
Until next time, keep questioning, keep learning, and keep exploring the past. Looking for the perfect way to show appreciation for the incredible mom in your life? Discover Exhausted Moms, a coloring journey to relaxation and humor, the coloring book that speaks directly to the heart of motherhood. Gift her an escape into pages of laughter, empowerment, and moments of tranquility. With Exhausted Moms, she'll find a blend of whimsical illustrations and inspiring quotes that celebrate her daily triumphs and challenges. Crafted with love from images I created for the mother of my children, each page offers a space for creativity and relaxation, a reminder that she's doing an amazing job, even on the toughest days. Give the gift of laughter, peace, and recognition. Exhausted Moms isn't just a coloring book, it's a hug, a nod of understanding, and a token of appreciation for everything she does. Surprise her with Exhausted Moms today and watch her face light up with joy. Because every mom deserves a moment to herself, wrapped in the colors of love and support.